ways of understanding how to live tomorrow, according to what had happened yesterday. But then, there are also the collections of the prophets themselves, the greater prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, for example, and the lesser prophets, Amos and Micah and Habakkuk and the rest. The prophets are, in a sense, the great theoreticians of the religious message contained otherwise in these historical books. The historical books were contained information, presumably immediately accessible, relevant, easy to understand for anybody. You see, they did well, and things worked fine for them. You see, they did badly, and things worked poorly for them. But along come the prophets to provide a kind of a theological explanation, to provide a kind of a philosophical explanation, to provide a message, to explain what it all means. A very large body of material, and in many respects, really, quite beautiful and quite moving literature. In the third place, there's a collection of material that bear the not terribly helpful name, the Writings. Now, what we have here is a kind of a catch-all designation for wisdom literature, for poetic material, for example, like the Psalms. Sometimes these were thought of as prophetic. Sometimes they were simply reckoned among the Writings, these instructive and uplifting documents. The Canticles, books like Proverbs, you see, books like Wisdom, full of pithy sayings, full of guides to life, full of ways to organize how you do things. Not so powerful, not so clear, not so direct as the prophets, but certainly nothing like the historical books, in that they don't tell a story, they don't narrate anything. Or if they narrate tiny stories, each story is simply meant to have a moral and doesn't necessarily connect to the story after it or to the one before it. So a large body of material designed in fundamental ways to tell people how to live well. And how to live well meant not how to be happy, how to enjoy yourself. It meant how to keep God's law. Now, the central religious ideas contained in the Hebrew Bible are, in the time that we have available to us, a little difficult to sort of capture briefly. Let's try to do that anyway. Here we have, unquestionably, one of the real foundation stones of Western civilization. What I want to do is look at some very basic ideas which can inform one's reading, one's appreciation, one's understanding of this body of material, but which also has the advantage for us, as historians, of saying what is important then, what was happening then, what did it mean then. And this reiterates a point that I've made any number of times in previous lectures already. History is always a kind of a dialogic process. There is, on the one hand, finding out what happened then and why and what it meant to those people, and then there is the process of the way that has been remembered subsequently all the way down to our own times. So in some very real ways, in talking about some of the basic ideas in the Hebrew Scriptures, what we're trying to do is understand then and many thens following on the first one. The first of these great ideas is the idea of a covenant, a pact, a bargain, a contract. It's created in the first instance between Yahweh and Abraham, between a god and a tribal leader, between a god and the followers, in fiction, the family of Abraham. They weren't necessarily all related to him, but this was the way it was remembered, that this was his great family, his extended family, a tribe, all right? This was then a covenant renewed on Mount Sinai between God and Moses for the people who had been forged in the Exodus from Egypt, in the wandering in the desert, a new people in a way, and so a new covenant with them. The covenant was then renewed a third time, and we find this in particular in the writings of the prophet Ezra. Now this was a time when these people had been dispersed, when these people had been exiled from their land. And so now the covenant, Yahweh doesn't fall out of it, nor does Abraham, nor does Moses, nor does the tradition, nor do all of these books that we talked about a moment ago. But now the covenant is understood particularly to be all those people who observe the Torah, wherever they may be, under what political system they may live. There's always the hope, perhaps, that they might be unified again. But for the time being, insofar as they are enduring exile, their covenant is now with the Torah. Now, the very idea of covenant itself is unique and distinctive and quite remarkable. It is the idea of a reciprocal relationship between a god and his people. One finds this again and again and again in the prophetic books. One finds it in the Psalms, for example. There are expressions there unlike those found anywhere else in the religious literature of any other people before this time in the world. When the psalmist cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? This is utterly remarkable. Looking into the face of God and saying, we made a deal, pay off. When the prophets again and again and again call upon God to honor his promises, this is so very and fundamentally different from the sort of thing we see in Mesopotamia, where all